Hey everyone, before we get to the show, we wanted to announce a very special event that's happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, October 8th and 9th. It's the Passive Income Pilots Conference. We've been talking about doing this for years and it's finally actually happening.
It's happening this year, 2026. So this October 8th and 9th, as you mentioned, Tate, in Las Vegas, you fly in on the 7th. We're going to have a happy hour meetup. And then there's two jam-packed days in a row where you're going to learn about lots of things. How do you save money on taxes, asset protection? What investment strategies are actually working in 2026 for pilots?
That's right.
That have been tremendously successful. We're going to do alternative investing and real estate investing and even talk about some things that are outside the box that maybe pilots aren't really thinking about. Tate, what else are we going to be doing at the event?
Well, we're going to have a huge panel of experts. It's going to be a big conference. We have 250 tickets for sale. And when you buy a ticket, you actually get to bring a spouse for free. Now, you can't bring your brother, your friend, or the FO that you're flying with for free. They have to buy their own ticket, but spouses come for free. Go to PassiveIncomePilots.com. You click on conferences and the tickets are on sale right now for $497. Prices do increase in August, so we encourage you to book early. It's at the M Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yeah, what's really fun is that it's on a Thursday and a Friday. So if you want to turn it into a Vegas weekend, bring your spouse. Maybe your spouse doesn't want to go to every single event. That's okay.
Right.
But they can pop in for the ones they want to see. And then you guys can turn it into an awesome weekend. Totally optional on that. But we look forward to seeing you at our very first ever PIP Live event in Las Vegas. See you there.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. Tate Duryea, Ryan Gibson here on another week of, well, aviation this week. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm good. Welcome to our longest episode we've ever recorded. But you know
That's
what?
Right.
Tate and I didn't get bored at all.
No.
So if you're a pilot thinking about flying, getting into aviation, you're an airline pilot, you want to know how many pilots we need by 2034. If you want to know the airline that has the best contract, if you want to know if we're beating inflation from the 1950s on these new pay scales or not.
That's right.
If you want to know who has the best retirement plan, the best profit sharing, who's hiring the most, how to get hired, tips for interview prep.
Who's retiring the most.
I mean, if you're in any career in aviation, this is a must listen episode. And I even recommend, if you can, get on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel called Passive Income Pilots and follow along with the slides. Now, if you're on your commute or something, the first like half an hour of the episode, you can just listen. But then I would kind of save the rest for watching the screen.
Definitely.
I mean, we went through
almost 200 slides.
200 slides, yeah. And yeah. A lot of the slides, he's like clicking, and I'm like, wait. I want to look at that slide.
So, I know.
Yeah. So I mean, if your kid is thinking about flying, if you're thinking about flying, if you're already in flying, this is going to be, yeah.
If you're in the military and you're thinking about the airlines, you're not sure whether it's, you know, do I want to go to Southwest, United, or FedEx. You know, this is going to be a key episode for you to listen to and really understand the differences between, you know, wide body versus narrow body, fleet types, long haul versus short haul, contracts, retirements, all that sort of stuff. So,
and the one thing I loved, the takeaway I had was, you know, the airlines, the economy sneezes, the airline catches a cold. And he shows that on a chart over history, right? And it's almost one for one correlated, right? GDP goes down, airline passenger employments go down, and all these things, right? And I think it made something stick out to me, which is this concept of anti-fragility, right? So we are not anti-fragile in the airlines, meaning that when the economy gets bad and you're a pilot, guess what? Your career is going to get bad, right?
Right. Said another way, it's not a recession-resistant business.
Correct. So if you're listening to this podcast, if this is the first episode you've ever listened to about us, you know, we're not on here giving investment advice. We bring on really well accomplished investment professionals, tax professionals, things like that, to talk about how you can actually diversify away from your airline career,
right,
and make a portfolio and a whole life financial picture that helps you through these like down periods where it gets really scary, right? Where
that is anti-fragile.
Anti-fragile. Yeah.
That's right.
So with that, let's get into the data and bring on our guest. Who is our guest today?
Our guest today is Captain Kit Darby. Mr. Kit Darby, he is the president of kitdarby.com, aviation consulting. He has a long history of aviation, but I'm going to let him talk about it because it's fascinating hearing it from his mouth. So without further ado, let's dive into aviation this week and let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Mr. Kit Darby, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Kit, I've been a fan and known who you are for a long time. I think when I started my search for airlines back in like 2002 or 2003, you were at a lot of, you know, had a lot of conferences and really did a lot of speaking engagements around pilot hiring. But can you just give our listeners a little bit of background of who you are?
Well, I'm a retired United pilot. Started out as an Army guy. Had I known how hard it was to be an airline pilot after being in the Army, I might have tried something else. Actually, I was Air Force ROTC and a six-year program with a four-year deferment during Vietnam, and that didn't work out too good. So I got drafted, ended up in Army Aviation. I did get some great advice from my mother, was working at Fort Bragg as a GS-12, basically an accountant, and her boss had wings on. And he called me in when I was in basic training in E1 and said, "So you want to be an airline pilot, eh?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, they're going to give you this piece of paper. And the piece of paper says fixed wing, rotary wing, or either. And if you check anything other than fixed wing only, you're going to be in a helicopter so fast it'll make your head spin." And back then, helicopter time might have actually been a negative. So today, a little different. But so I checked fixed wing and they laughed and went off to OCS, sitting there waiting to go to flight school. And they kept saying, "You know, you're not going. Fixed wing is reserved for those coming back from Vietnam and general sons and that kind of stuff." But I held on for a few months and they eventually put me in a class, 300 rotary wing, 30 fixed wing. 20 of those were warrant officers, most of which already had an ATP. And 10 of us were commissioned. And 8 of those already had a license through the ROTC program. And there were 2 of us that had never flown before. And we had to solo in 10 hours or we were second lieutenants on the ground in Vietnam. And I was infantry. So I was a highly motivated student. But that all worked out. And then they said at the end of the training, "Too many fixed wing pilots right now. You're going to go to Vietnam. But where would you like to wait?" So I waited at Fort Bragg, my hometown. And waited and waited. And eventually they came down and said, "You're going to Germany." And I said, "Great. I was hoping not to go to Vietnam. What am I flying?" And they said, "Oh, no, sir. I made captain about a week earlier. Said, "You're an infantry captain. You're going to have a platoon in the Black Forest in Germany and our company." I mean, and I said, that's not really part of the plan. We're trying to be an airline pilot here." And they said, "Well, the other thing we have is helicopter school. And if we do that, you're going to have to be in a helicopter for 3 years, a utilization tour." And I said, "Well, that's not part of the plan either, but at least I'm flying, so I'll take helicopters." And toward the end of that, I went out to, in the Army, the department got all the fancy stuff, all the additional airplanes, instructor courses, and all that, a Department of Graduate Flight Training. And I sauntered in there and said, "Hey, I want to be a flight commander." And they said, "Yeah, you and everybody else in the Army, you know, why should we hire you?" Well, it turns out I had become an instructor at Bragg during the fuel shortage. The only ones getting any flight time were the instructors. So I volunteered for that. Turned out I really liked it. Machine, always thought it did the same thing, but interfacing with the pilots was quite challenging. So they said, "How much flight time you got?" And at the time I had about 2,200 hours and I was about 3.5 years in here. And that was a lot of flight time for a military pilot. And they said, "How much instructor time you got?" And I had about 1,000 hours instructor time. And they said, "You know, you might be a flight commander." So they made a request for 2,000 hours or more. And I was like the only guy that had it. So I went right out of my helicopter qualification back into airplanes. And they put me in a King Air, Queen Air flight, neither airplane I've ever flown. I have these other airplanes I've flown. I instruct in those. I said, "That's okay. We're the school. 2 aircraft transitions, 2 aircraft IP courses, and I'm the flight commander of the King Air, Queen Air flight, U8, U21. So I hung around there for a while, went over to the T-41, T-42 flight, ended up at the IP flight. And I'd pretty much done everything the Army had to offer me. And by that time, I had about 4,400 hours, which was a ton of time for a military pilot in what turned out to be 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
And So it came time to make a decision. So I had to either go off to, I had weaseled my way into a test pilot slot, and or I could get out. And I decided to get out. I had I was a acting fixed wing branch chief at Flight Standards, and the new King Airs were arriving, the B-100s, and I was supposed to go off and fly those, or I could get out, which was a scary proposition years ago because you didn't have any kind of transition. And I decided to get out, went to work for Flight International here in Atlanta. I first went to see them. They said, no way, you're going to get hired. We're not going to hire you. 2 days later, some instructor got hired and they didn't have an instructor. So I got the job. And shortly after that, I went to work for Braniff, which was at the time pretty easy to do if you had an engineer ticket. And after working for Braniff for two or three years, they went out of business. So I went to my family, had a business in Myrtle Beach, Coastal Magazine, and I was going to wait. Major airline had never failed. I was going to go back to Braniff. I was very happy there. Living in Miami, flying DC-8s as a co-pilot to South America, I was happy as a pig. So, but they did the rudest thing ever. They went out of business. So I jumped back in the job market and I got hired by Capital. And Capital, I had not applied to Capital. So that was a real surprise. The chief pilot called me. He had a list of Braniff pilots and I was one of them. And he said, DC-8 co-pilot? Yes, sir. Class starts on Monday. That was the entire interview. And I lived in Myrtle Beach. The job was in New York. You can't get there from here. I said, I can't do it. I can't make an on-call from Myrtle Beach, and I can't live in New York. He said, oh, no, that's not how it works. We'll call you when we need you, and you get here when you can. And I said, bullshit. I don't think that's quite the way it works. I've been an airline pilot for a while. And he said, no, call your buddies. And he called me the next week, said, you didn't show up. I said, I told you I wasn't going to show up. He said, you call your buddies? I said, I did. And you're right. You can actually live where you live and get there when you can. So I'll be there on Monday.
What kind of flying were they doing that you could just show up when you wanted?
Well, they would roll crews. So they would use local, co-pilots in the area, vicinity, coming off of trips for other trips, whatever, until you got there. I mean, it was absurd, but that's what they did. But it did allow you to live anywhere and allowed me to take the job. And I recommended a friend of mine who was not a DC-8 co-pilot. He was had flown, didn't upgrade. And he said he wouldn't take my recommendation because he wasn't a qualified co-pilot. He was there on Monday, and the instructor's going over, you guys know all about this mode control panel, how to fly DC-8s. And my friend raised his hand and said, okay, we'll take care of you at lunch. And he became a DC-8 co-pilot right along with the rest of us, never having touched a DC-8. So anyway, it was interesting. But eventually I made captain in 9 months, 35 years old, DC-8 captain, flying all over the world, making co-pilot pay. And of course they did the second rudest thing. They also went out of business. So now I'm back in the job market. And at that point I had, I started doing resumes locally, and electronic typewriters were coming out, and I got an electronic typewriter. I think I ended up with 15 of them, and we started doing resumes for all the Capital folks. And about that time I bought into FAPA, Future Airline Pilots at the time. And we started a resume service there, added salary surveys, magazines. It grew from 350,000 to 3.5 million or whatever. I got forced out there. I had a percentage deal. Percentage got too good, and I was forced out. So I started my own. That was Air Inc., and that ran until 9/11. And shortly after 9/11, our business went to nothing, and I ended up transitioning over to Air Inc. Was able to offload my previous company to various other companies, and it was a really tough time. So, but we reestablished it now, just a small group. I have a few retired captains that are interviewers, a resume lady, so we do application reviews, resumes, interview preparation. And I counsel a lot of people, pilots that have problems. So if there are accident, incident, violation, training failure, people with more serious issues, of course, after COVID-22-23, if you could spell airline pilot, you could probably be one pretty quick. So they didn't need me too much then, but we're doing that. my main business, along the way, I did a salary survey back in 1985 when we started. And I still do that today, but I don't publish it publicly. And that's really my main business these days. So pilots, injured, killed, delayed, divorced, whatever, I can put a number on their career, pay, benefits, and retirement. What's it worth? And been doing that for quite a while now. And that's my main business. It's what pays the bills these days. And that's, you'll see a lot of my stuff. If you look at me on LinkedIn or Facebook, I put most of that information up there for free.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. But I just wanted to pause for a second and say, if you're a flight instructor or looking into getting into flying and you think that it's hard, listening to Kit's story, I think relative is the key word here.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple of airlines going out of business, you know, being in the military, flying thousands of hours. We've got it pretty darn good. If you're a flight instructor, I mean, yeah, maybe you get stuck teaching students for an extra couple of years, but.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, to put it in perspective, most of the major airlines had ever hired in a single year was 5,000 pilots prior to COVID. They did that three times, you know.
Right.
So then coming out of COVID in the last half of 2021, they hired 5,000. And then they hired 13,000 and 12,000. So in a 2.5 year period, we hired 30,000 pilots. And it was unreasonably easy to get the job. We have a minister in our neighborhood who hadn't flown for 20 years. And he went back to work for a regional and he's working for Southwest 9 months later. So, I mean, incredible opportunities. That's not normal. I mean, it's wonderful for the pilots who are involved in it, but it's just not normal. This year, in perspective, we're going to have 8,000, maybe a few more. That's going to be the third best year in history. It would have been the best year except for the COVID exception. So as sad as it may seem compared to 22-23, that's not normal. And what we have now in any other environment would have to be categorized as an excellent job market, you know, and we're starting to see rotary transition programs come back. You know, minimums will probably stay the same, but the average qualifications will come down. Last time around, we dropped vision 4-year degrees. We started counting helicopter time. There were advertisements in major newspapers. We're headed back there right now. I don't know if we'll go quite as good as COVID, but we have a really good market. So things you tried last year, the low point was the summer of last year. It was really sort of things were backed up that people that were hiring, a lot of uncertainty. Things were at the low point. It started picking up last fall. It stayed picked up all the way through today. You have a pool of pilots and you hire a fair number out of it on a regular basis. You begin to eat into that supply. And everybody will say, oh, there's 10 or 12,000 pilots on file. Yeah, it's the same 10 or 12,000 pilots in all those companies. So if you eat up 8,000 of them, and all of those pretty much come from the regionals, our military is about 20% now. So stay tuned. I mean, the things you tried last year didn't work, might work this year, and certainly might work early next year. So keep after it. You know, my two favorite words in the job search are patience and persistence.
Great advice.
And a lot of times when I talk to people, I get them revved up about the market and then nothing happens for 3 months and they're all depressed and don't do anything. Well, what's going to work best is this steady, even pressure. Another approach on it is, you know, you want to have good paperwork. We do resume. I was the first one to do app reviews. So we had a resume business and people would send us their airline apps to use to write their resume, which we would do. But we would also look at it and go, oh my God, you didn't turn this in, did you? I mean, in the misspellings, didn't answer the question, gave way too much information. You know, it was just a mess. So that was like 10 or 12 years ago, I started doing app reviews. Now you can get them anywhere at twice the price, but a lot of people do app reviews and we get a feel for what's going on pretty fast. We see who's getting interviews. And I kept a database of that for 15 years, probably got 15,000 people that were either interviewed or hired.
I was going to ask you really quick. You know, I always had the philosophy, this is like maybe 20 years ago, that you should be prepared to write like a $20,000 check to get hired, right? That's interview prep, travel, conferences, a new suit, a good haircut, flying around. You know, what would you put on that number? Like somebody who's thinking about best positioning themselves for a multi-million dollar career now, right? And timing matters, right?
We'll see the new careers. I mean, the hourly rates in the new FedEx contract in 2030 will exceed $500 an hour, be $512 an hour. So if you work a regular month, an 80-hour month, you're getting $40,000 a month. So, you know, whatever the check amount is, how long does it take to pay it back at $40,000 a month? Just not very long. You know, right. it pays off pretty quick. Exactly. But again, you have to be able
pretty
to
good ROI.
Afford it today. Yeah. And we should acknowledge that pilots are basically frugal, and they should be. So get what you need, but don't spend any more than you have to do it. You know, do it in an orderly manner. You wouldn't want to get your type rating first. That's the most expensive item. You get your type rating last,
right,
and do the other stuff right along the way. But eventually, you get yourself as qualified as you can until you get the job you want. I bought a type rating, so.
Yeah.
So I want to bring everybody up to speed. So it's kitdarby.com, obviously consulting, app review. And can you clarify, do you do interview prep as well?
We do. Yeah, I got a couple of retired captains that are doing interview prep, and a couple of them are 100%. They really do a good job.
And I think the interview prep is so important. You know, I got a really funny story. A buddy of mine was interviewing at my airline, I don't know, 15 years ago. And they're going around the room and saying, you know, hey, can you tell us about a time that you learned something in aviation or that you made a mistake? Maybe you didn't violate an FAR, but, you know, you made a mistake and you learned from. And they're going around the room and this guy, let's call him Dave, goes, yeah, well, you know, this one time a captain and I are flying and, you know, we were a little delayed and we're like up against our FAR time. And so anyway, we push back, we go, and gosh, about an hour into the flight, we both just fell asleep. And the whole room was like, oh. Okay, so what did you learn from that? And he's like, well, maybe we just should have, you know, drank more coffee. And he's joking. And he's like, well, that's the last time we saw Dave.
Yeah.
So really important to go and get some interview prep and make sure you don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we can't change your life. I mean, your life is your life, but we can change the way you present your life.
Right.
You know, what you choose to do and so forth. My favorite story along those lines is a helicopter pilot, you know, flying down the road in Afghanistan. IED blows up. He gets permission, swoops down, picks up the wounded, carries him to the hospital. Man, what a fantastic story. But at the end of it, he's down there with a plastic bag picking up body parts, you know, and the HR ladies throw it up in the corner. So we said, boy, that's a great story, but let's leave off the plastic bag and the body part and tell the story. Right. It's a great story without it. So like I said, we can't change your life. We can change the way you present your life. And the other big point on interviewing, I always love to ask, I said, how'd that first ILS go? And they think back and go, you know, that first ILS, that was pretty ugly. And I said, how's it look now? Oh, it looks really good now. What's the difference? Practice. You know, why would you go into, like you said, the average career value for 30 years is $17 million before the FedEx contract. So why would you go into that kind of interview without just a little bit of practice? I mean, you might be okay and you might not. I like to equate it to putting somebody upside down the first time as an interview and see how you do. Half of them will roll it back out and fly away, get the job, and the other half will pull it into the ground and kill themselves. So I don't want to do it without practice. I want a little bit of practice here, even if you think you don't need it, because quite honestly, we're not very good at evaluating ourselves. Might add the airline's not very good at evaluating you either, but it's their dance. So
I always felt too that, like, because I did interview prep for a firm for a couple of years. And I, you know, one thing that I took away from that was you really only need about, I mean, Kit, you're the expert on this, obviously, you've been doing this for decades, but I always kind of felt like you only really need 5 stories.
Oh, yeah.
And
I
those
agree.
5 stories.
Same number I use.
Yeah. Those, mm-hmm. Yeah, 5 stories. And those 5 stories can really apply to any question you get. So it's overwhelming when you look at the gouge and it says, you know, here's the 55 questions they can ask you, and you think you got to have 55 stories for every question. Then you realize, like, that story about your emergency applies to teamwork. It applies to handling an emergency. It applies to the stress question. It applies to lots of things, right?
I agree.
And it's like, you just really need to get those 5 stories that are your stories. And then, like you said, kind of brush them up a little bit to execute them in a way that tells it in a way that doesn't make HR go puke in the back. You know, I mean, it's,
well, it's so true. I love the hamburger story too. So when you're telling that story, like telling a good joke, you know, how do I do that? Well, you have the details of that story. So I always say, you know, do you want a hamburger? Well, no, I'm trying to lose weight. I mean, you're trying to sell yourself to this person who doesn't want a hamburger. Well, how about a bacon cheeseburger? Oh, yeah, I really like bacon cheeseburgers, but I'm trying to lose weight. You know, how about the toasted sesame seed bun with the special sauce? Oh, okay, I'll have a hamburger. You know, I mean, the detail, the only person that has the details of that story in that interview is you. And you can choose which ones you tell them. If there were some negative aspects of them, you could leave it out and still have a great, I'm going to buy the hamburger story. So that's really important to realize that they get all, that they just got to spill their guts and there were some areas that they didn't want to talk about. Don't talk about them. They're not going to know what, except what you tell them, except for what's in the record. So the first step is to check the record. If you have a record, training record, driving record, whatever record it is, check the record. That has to be covered in your story. After that, the details you give are up to you. And we should be able to shape that. You know, Delta does a 1-6 scoring system. They don't hire a lot of 1, 2s, and 3s. They hire mostly 3, 4, 5s, and 6s, you know, the higher numbers. And with a little coaching, you could probably get another number or two out of that story. So, you know, fighter guys are famous. You know, they just stop thinking about the passengers and dispatch. And, you know, they're not talking to anybody. They're a one-man show. So they tell a story, good story, but it's a 3. If they remember to act like an airline pilot, then they pick up those extra points. It's not that hard to do, but a little practice would be recommended.
Well, Kit, I wanted to switch gears a little bit because we have a lot of pilots who are listeners who are already employed by the airlines. And obviously hiring trends are going to matter to them because that pushes them up in seniority. Unless you're super senior, it doesn't matter quite as much. I think retirement trends also matter, and then also contract trends. But before we do, I have a question for you. You have flown the DC-8, the 727, the 737, the DC-9. You've also got training experience on the 75, 76, the 71, the Mad Dog. What was your favorite airplane to fly?
I would have to say the 717.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
yeah, smallest one, highly automated, you know, 35 years old now.
I might share that with you. I flew the 71. That was my first upgrade, and that is a fun airplane to fly.
I mean, a lot of airplanes, you can buy airplanes today that won't do a single engine ILS and go around on the autopilot. I mean, you can buy brand new airplanes today that won't do that. And that airplane did it 35 years ago. So it's sort of like the difference between an Apple and a PC. They both sort of do the same thing, but the 717 was very elegant in the things that it did, even though it's about to retire. So, I mean, I realized I thought the prettiest one was the 757, and the one that took me around the world was the 767. The most concerning and the most difficult to teach on and to fly was the MD-88. I mean, I understand the mad part and the dog part. I mean, it's I mean, most of these airplanes, when you're at altitude, you're limited by pressurization on, you know, your service ceiling. In a Mad Dog, you're out of wing and motor. I mean, this thing is a pig. So that's my impression. So, and I was teaching on that after
the safe airplane.
After flying the 717.
Climbs like a safe and comes down like a safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was teaching on it, and I've never seen an airplane that required so much technique just to fly it safe. I mean, I wasn't trying to fly it really good. I was just trying not to go off the runway. I mean, you know, it's lousy brakes. Can't apply reverse because it blocks the rudder. I mean, what a nightmare. I mean, the only thing that flew worse, I mean, it had a lot of, the DC-8 flew like a door. I mean, I know guys that love the DC-8, but I'd have to ask him, have you ever flown anything else? I mean, this thing's got like a truck with the power steering off. But the 88 was absolutely the worst. I mean, and I taught on it a lot because I could see that I was teaching the ATP-CTP course, and I could see we were only doing Boeing and McDonnell Douglas. The Airbuses were too busy. We never got those simulators. And I could see that a lot of training was going to be done in MD-88 as the fleet went down and the simulators remained. So I volunteered for that, and I had to shake my head after doing that. I had to do a brain transplant to go back to, it's hard to put the word glass with baby glass, but it's, you know, all it means is you've got a glass attitude indicator, you know, that's about it.
Right. Let's get into the trends. Yeah. And if you're listening to this on Apple, you know, I think we actually are adding video to Apple Podcasts. So if you want to check it out, Kit's got some slides that he's going to share. And if for any reason your podcast isn't showing the video, check it out on YouTube. You can come over to our YouTube channel, Passive Income Pilots, and you'll see the video there.
Okay. Let me go to share my screen. And there we go. Is that looking better?
Yep.
Okay.
It is.
Perfect.
Hey, where'd my logo come from on that thing?
Yeah, some guy with a screen capture on the internet, probably. All right. So anyway, so this is my last, I never really finished my story. So I did Braniff. I did Capital. I got hired by United. Republic for like 2 weeks, and I decided to leave Republic and go to United. I worked till age 60, retired off to 67, went to work for Boeing for 5 years on a 7-3 instructor and then a 717 instructor, which got me to Delta. Delta hired 4 Boeing instructors when they got the 717s to help train the instructors and write the manuals, and I did that. And a few years in, I switched over to the ATP CTP course. So, like I said, my favorite airplane, one of the first airplanes with 6 glass screens, you know, fabulously automated, especially for its age. My military airplane was an OV-1, you know, Stoll aerobatic, single pilot, all the fun you're allowed to have in the Army. There's a limit. So it was really a great plane. I got about 2,500 hours in it, almost all of it as an instructor. So retired captain, 24,000, 7,000 in sims, 6,000 military. So total of 37,000 if you're counting. So ATP instructor at Delta, I retired from that. And then I went to work for Sanders Aviation in Jasper, Alabama, because I missed it. So I'm still teaching. So I certified the Delta program with the FAA ground school and sim. And I certified the ground school for Sanders Aviation. So I've been doing ATP CTP for 13 years now, ever since it started. So you may remember these old publications, you know, we published 5,000 pages a year. Today we're talking about hiring trends, you know, how to make people a good candidate. I'm not going to do the electronic resumes and applications, although those are available online in another location if you want to try it. So app reviews, up-to-date information, you know, we're a big advocate for informed decisions, you know, make the best decision you can and live with it. It's a seniority system. Once you get on that one-way escalator, you're not getting off unless you get sick or die. Understand the recruiting environment. So this is what happened at 9/11. At COVID. When COVID hit, I sat down and said, what's going to happen without any information? So I drew this day one of COVID. And we were two or three months in right here. Red was actual. Okay. And then I made what I thought might happen. And then I upgraded it 10 times. It went lower than I thought, but it came back pretty close to my middle estimate of what was going to happen.
And can you explain what the percentage means? Is that hiring?
That's passengers.
Trends?
That's
passenger counts. Okay.
RPMs.
So 95% reduction in passenger counts.
RPM reduction right there. So, and then the CARES Acts 1, 2, and 3 came in, and the vaccine mandate, and the vaccines 1, 2, 3, and the booster. And by the time we got done with that and the CARES Act was ending, they could see the end in sight. They were right about here, and you can't furlough somebody for 3 months and save any money. So they pretty much kept everybody. I might add that the CARES Act prohibited anybody from being furloughed. So there were no extended furloughs at COVID. There were a few people here and there that were furloughed for a few weeks. And then the government said, we'll give you all this money, but you can't furlough anybody. And they all came back. And it wasn't just a little bit of money. It was $243 billion put into just our industry, trillions of dollars over the whole U.S. industry. So really two recoveries, one domestic, one international. You really couldn't go anywhere international unless you were prepared to quarantine for 2 weeks. So that didn't work too good. Passenger cargo, same thing. Cargo recovered very quickly. Passengers, not so much. There's a long-term trend that was happening in 2019, and we're back above it now. You know, we've exceeded our previous expectations. the what's happening now. So this is like looking at the tariffs and the fuel prices in particular. So this is this year in April. It really only went negative 1 month based on fuel. I mean, available, it's available seat kilometers because my source is, you know, not US and it's not miles, but kilometers, but only went negative one short time and it's remained positive since. So, and of course, the price of fuel is really the problem. And the price of fuel for cars is not anything like what it is for airplanes. There's a difference between making the fuel, and that difference between making a car gas gallon and a jet fuel gallon is called a crack spread. What it costs to crack the what you want from that gallon of crude oil, and the price for jet fuel was running $100 a barrel, not the 60 or 70, and the price after the Strait of Hormuz close was $200 an hour. So we're not really talking about $60 a barrel. We're talking about $100 to start with, and we're talking about $200 after the Strait closed, and it's trended back down a little bit. So this is the crack spread in red.
And obviously that's a 55-gallon barrel,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So essentially at $200 a barrel for jet fuel, that would be $3.63 a gallon.
Yeah, I'll show you that in just a second. So you can see the, there it is, 241. There's car gas. I mean, jet fuel prices, 241 to, you know, that was in March, which was sort of the peak of it.
Right.
So
right.
Fuel prices around the world, you know, slightly different in different regions. The ones that are in the worst shape are the island nations, you know, England, the islands in the Pacific. I mean, there's no other source. You have to buy it and import it or you don't have it. So this is what happens to the profit margin when you apply the additional fuel cost to the regions of the world. Not too bad in North America because we are actually fuel positive. We make more raw material than we use. So the ones that are really bad, Pacific and Africa and Middle East, are paying a huge price and turning their business negative. And my comment here is this can't go on for long. I mean, can go on for a little while, but it can't go on for long. I mean, something's got to give. So no problem. We'll hedge our fuel, right? So the U.S. airlines, Delta, American, United, Southwest, Alaska, JetBlue, they hedge fuel for years. You know, and it turns out it's sort of like insurance. So you buy fuel at a given price, and later on, if it's more, you save money. If it's less, it costs you money. So they analyzed that over a pretty good period of time and figured out that the insurance they were buying costs more than the damage that was done by not having a fuel hedge. Right. So they all got rid of it, all of them. And then, of course, we have this current situation, which is the absolute best time to have a fuel hedge would be to be buying $200 gas at $100, but didn't happen. So we don't have it. The next question is how long, what do the reserves look like? So if we ran out, how long before we run out? This is a jet fuel imported. So who imports the most? Again, the island nations, you know, Europe and so forth, they import the most. And what kind of reserve do they have? So here's the reserve, anywhere from 1.6 to 4 months. That's it. That's the whole reserve. After that, you're buying gas on the open market and you have no reserve. So very serious position to be in, and nobody's over 4 months.
Can I ask a clarifying question on the hedging? Because I was generally aware that U.S. airlines had stopped hedging just because it didn't make financial sense. It's interesting to see some of the European carriers, EasyJet at 84%, Wizz Air at 83%. Ryanair 80%, Lufthansa at 77%. Does that mean that 77% of Lufthansa's fuel needs for 2026 were purchased through hedging programs, or
yes,
basically is protected?
Yeah, there's another aspect. I say protected. It's only protected if it goes up. You pay more
right,
if it goes down.
If it goes down, then it hurts you. So are those European airlines in a better position having made those hedges than U.S. airlines in 2026?
In the short term, yes.
Right.
You know, but the other aspect of that is it stabilizes your business. One of the whole problems with fuel going up and down is you can't predict a profit or a loss. So if you have a straight line fuel, which hedging gives you, you can plan your business to a profit. If the fuel goes down, you make a fortune. If the fuel goes up, you lose money on hedging. But here, at least you know your costs and you plan your ticket price and your business to a profit. And that's key. I mean, profits, we fly more routes, hire more pilots. I mean, profits are key.
Very interesting. Thanks.
And if you're not following along on the slide deck, you know, Delta, American, United, Southwest, none of the American carriers have any hedge for 2026.
None. Zero. So to give you an idea of how much the jet fuel is of our supply, imports and production, it's a very small part, jet fuel demand, and we do export a tiny amount. So I don't know that that would change. That's probably under a long-term contract. But anyway, it gives you an idea that jet fuel is just not very important in the big picture of things, really important to an airline pilot or to an airline passenger, but in the big scheme of things. So there's two issues here. If the price of fuel goes up, then the cost of the airline goes up to provide the service. If the price goes up in a supply and demand, I like to think of the airline as a commodity. And a lot of people say, oh, well, I don't know. Well, think of an airline seat and we're bolted into an airplane and we fly that seat. So that's the commodity. It's like a loaf of bread or a dozen eggs or whatever. So if that's our commodity, then how does a commodity respond to more or less supply? The price goes up. How does it respond to increased cost? The price goes up. So those things cause the cost to go up. That's one thing. And that's really significant from a pilot's point of view. But it's even more significant if you look at this chart and realize that most of the gas doesn't go to flying. Most of it goes to trucks and cars and all that. If their price went up, the whole economy would be able to afford less and would do less. And that could have a bigger effect on the market than the incremental increase in jet fuel.
What percentage breakdown is jet fuel again?
Well, it's on this. I don't see the percentage, but it looks like it's less than 10%. It's less than probably 7%. You see, I mean, yeah. It's the red off to the right there out of the 100% on the left. And on the right side, you know, 7 or 8% would be my guess. So we don't have a total number anywhere. We could do the math. Oh, okay. We got production. We got 5 and 2.5. So we got 7.5. And the jet demand is 634. So definitely less than 10%. So if I, yeah. So it's small.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know if anybody else looks at it, but I look at the OAG because the OAG is the airlines give the OAG, the official airline guide, their schedule plan in the future. And they know what it is. So the dotted line is where what the forecast was. The solid line, blue line is total traffic, yellow line domestic, orange line international. And the airlines in the middle of this fuel crisis did not cut their flights. I mean, they've gutsy move from my point of view. I would at least expect it to level off, but no, it just keeps right on climbing. And that has continued. It's amazing, you know, that they would do that.
And do you think that's because of the ability for the top half of the economy to pay?
Yeah, flying is not a something that people that are less fortunate do much of. So another aspect is that during COVID, a lot of people didn't ride corporate, but they could afford it, but they chose not to do it, or they didn't have money in the beginning, so they learned how to fly the airlines. And then all of a sudden, they didn't want to get an aluminum tube with 300 of their closest friends, and they went off to fly corporate. In the same token, there was pent-up demand after COVID to fly the airlines. So there's a lot of drivers behind the scenes here. I have another theory too, and I have unable to prove it. But in hard times, you tell people, you know, times are hard. You have the same job, you make the same money, but you fly a discount airline because it's hard times, not because you have any less resources. And in good times, the reverse. You know, you're making the same money, but it's good times. You know, people are making money, companies are profitable. The economic forecasts are strong. So you ride first class or you ride a premium airline. It has nothing to do with your ability to afford the service. It's only the mental attitude that things are either hard or easy. So again, I hope to prove that someday, but it's certainly, if you look at the history of the traffic in those two segments, premium flying and low-cost flying, they do seem to respond to a down market with more traffic for the low-cost airlines and the reverse for a good economy.
It's kind of hard to look at that data too, because I mean, I remember like Spirit Airlines was the king of the lower cost of the seats, right? But then all the legacies kind of responded with the cabin configuration and attracting the lower, you know, having the lower paying passengers have more of an option in the back, right? So,
well, the government squashed it, and you have to wonder who's driving the boat. I mean, the reason given was that it would be a reduction for the merger that they wanted, several mergers that they wanted, would have been a reduction in competition. Well, how is the reduction in competition looking now when they're out of business?
I can
tell you how it looks. The prices pretty much everywhere they were, the prices went up 20%. That's how competition looks. So very short-sighted not to grant those mergers and allow that company to survive and compete rather than die and have the prices bounce up 20%. That's just crazy. It's counter to the argument that they used to deny the merger. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And what mergers have been denied in the last 20 years? I mean, hardly any, I don't think, other than that one.
I mean, well, there have been, I don't know if it was denied. I mean, there was a United US Air for a while that was pretty much denied by the pilots, So moving on, this is not a current chart, just to show that retirements are also a big part. So it's usually about 50% growth and 50% retirement. It's a little heavy on the retirement right now. We have a good, strong retirement. And the growth, you know, I'd still have to call the growth, which is strong, iffy because of the dramatic uncertainty, you know, a couple of wars, tariffs, fuel prices. I mean, it's very uncertain right now what's going to happen. And most of the outcomes of those things I mentioned are not positive for the airlines. So put it cumulative, you know, lots of retirements. That part we can count on. Here's a forecast I made years ago. The blue are the major airlines, the orange, the regional, the gray, the corporate, and the small amount at the top are early in medical. So we lose about 0.5% a year to medical, and a few people win the lottery or whatever and stop flying. So put it together, there was a need for 80,000 pilots, and that's actually looking a little low right now. So moving on, pilots didn't really care too much about the traffic other than the way it affects their job. So I converted it to pilot jobs, you know, ratio of pilots to RPMs or to airplanes or flight hours. And this was day one. I sat down, well, probably day two, because I did have some stimulus effect in here. So
COVID.
Yeah. So it was, we were going to start hiring somewhere in going into 23. But because of the next one here, the early retirements, we retired 6,000 pilots across the majors. And that moved it back from, you know, to the middle of 21. And that's exactly what happened with the stimulus effect, the hour reductions for some crews, 6,000 early retirements. So we noticed 10,000, you know, the Warren Act where you have to tell union employees 30 days before you furlough them. So we warned 30,000 and we were going to warn another, I'm sorry, we warned 10,000 and we were going to warn another 10,000, which would have been the 20,000 that I have right here. But the CARES Act came out and that didn't happen. They couldn't furlough and get the money. So again, there's the CARES 1, 2, 3 vaccine mandate with the vaccines coming in. So
very interesting.
Here's the stimulus granted by the government to the airlines. And this is just the airlines. I mean, like I said, it was multiple trillions of dollars for the country, and $243 billion is just an amazing number for the airlines alone.
Wow.
And there was a lot of concern about inflation. And I look at that and go, let's see, we put $243 billion in and we restrict the supply a little bit due to delivery of airplanes, engines, accessories, that kind of stuff. Would you expect the price to go up if you gave somebody $243 billion and then restricted the supply of what they want to buy? Probably not, you know. So we also have furloughs. There really weren't any furloughs. This is the history we talked about, 500, 5,000, 500, 5,000. going to be 5,000, but it died with the Great Recession in 08, 09. JetBlue hired 30 pilots in January, and that was it. So that's the cycle prior to COVID. This was a little forecast I made back in 23, trying to understand this tremendous shortage that took place. The airlines gave OAG a plan to grow 15%, the classic airline overexpand, cut back, overexpand, cut back. We call it shark's teeth, you know, up and down. They couldn't do it. They could not get the pilots to staff the 15% increase in flying. That's 16 pilots per plane. That's 11,000 pilots that didn't go to work because they couldn't get the crews to make it work. The regionals gave up their captains, and they parked 500 airplanes, 500 wow. multi-million dollar jets.
Wow.
Times 12. That's another 6,000 pilots.
And this is in 2023.
23. This was the peak of the COVID rush. Corporate aviation, they wanted to grow 10%. They couldn't do it. 2.5 pilots per plane. Military, very hard to get your hand around it, but the Air Force alone would tell you that at that point they were 2,000 fighter pilots short. So that's a modest number. So there's 24,000 pilot jobs that didn't take place because we couldn't train them fast enough. We couldn't get captains with 1,000 hours under the Airline Safety Act. We just had to park the planes. And you could not buy a corporate airplane or rent a corporate airplane or find a corporate pilot during that period. And I'll show you later, I did a survey on the National Business Aircraft Association survey 2 years apart, 20 and 22. And the pay rate, corporate pay rate, co-pilots and captains went up 50% because if they didn't pay them, they were going to lose them.
Wow. It's incredible.
So what was happening? You know, we've always had a need for pilots, and we've pretty much always gotten the airplanes we needed pretty much when we needed them. You know, we ordered them and we got them. Maybe we delayed that order if the economy was down, but big airlines get their airplanes. But all of a sudden, we have airplanes that are being built, ordered, paid, deposit paid for, and not deliverable because they're not certified. That would be the MAX 7 and 10. And the 777X. So that's sort of unheard of. I mean, we've never had an equipment restriction before. Slow delivery. We're supposed to deliver 52 737 MAX 9s a month, and they're delivering 32, and they didn't even make that after the MAX crashes. And, of course, the 787 was also slowed. So a reduced rate and the supply chain problems restricting it. And then the Airbus, with their using geared turbofan engines, and those parts were made of powdered metal. And the powdered metal turned out not to be as durable as they thought. So when they inspected these turbine blades, some of them had excessive wear, took a maintenance slot to inspect them, and then it takes another maintenance slot to repair them, and parts. Well, parts were in short supply. This is coming up, but this is 850 Airbuses worldwide, probably half of them in the U.S., and it doesn't affect all airlines the same. Delta had older Airbuses that didn't have these newer engines. JetBlue had mostly newer Airbuses that did have these engines. So you could have one airline with almost no effect and another airline with half the fleet parked. Big differences. So inspections, parts, and repairs, this is a long-term problem. This has been going on for about a year, and it's going to go on for another year or two. So to look at what that looks like, this was the Boeing lack of certification and the Airbus lack of engines. By the way, the average engine in the peak of this was off the wing for a year. So this wasn't just go fix it and come back tomorrow. This was airplanes grounded because we didn't have engines for up to a year.
I experienced this firsthand. I was a Czech airman on the 321neo. And, we had a third of our fleet was grounded, sitting there without engines on the wings.
That's about the right number. I'll show you a chart in a minute here that has the percentage of A320s that are parked. Okay. But this is cumulative, by the way. It's not, we didn't build that many and then we add to it. It's this year plus this year plus this year. I mean, I estimate we're 1,000 airplanes short in the U.S. of what we would have been had we had airplanes that were certified and engines that were flyable.
Yeah, I mean, we have 777s sitting all over Payne Field and Everett right now, too. I mean, they've been parked there for I think going on 2 years now.
Yeah.
Due to lack of certification. I mean, it's crazy. They've shut down multiple runways and they're just parked all over the airfield.
And that will recover very quickly. And it looks like late this year, early next year, it's going to recover. So those airplanes, they will have to have some work done because the approval for the certification often included some additional changes to the airframe. So the ones that were just built can be delivered right away. And the ones that were first built may need a little work, but they should come into the marketplace relatively quickly. Whereas the Airbuses have to be inspected and repaired, and that's going to take a while based on the capacity of maintenance to do that.
So, Kit, I mean, your bottom line here is like you're basically saying that there's a lot of airplanes that never entered service that should have entered service, which would have created even more demand for pilots on top of the demand that we already have.
There should have been a couple of more 10,000 pilot years, should have been. But
wow.
The only good thing I will say is because boom and bust, we did take the top off the boom. And that may take the bottom off the downturn. So
that's
it may
very
have
good point.
Artificially stabilized the airlines against their will, but it probably did that. So
save them from themselves.
Yeah, things happen for a reason, right?
Right.
And yeah.
So here's the Airbuses. The green is what was ordered. The actual is orange and the difference in blue. So it's you know, the difference is going down. The deliveries are going up. We're doing better. Lost aircraft and pilots. You know, we lose a lot of pilots to staff these airplanes, an average of 12, 13 pilots per plane. So this was a chart. Everybody took a big sigh of relief when it turned down at 650. It turned out just to be momentary. I haven't seen a chart yet, but it went to 850, okay? And now it's actually trending down. So it is going to resolve itself, but it's going to be a year or two before it's over. This is the percentages of all geared turbofans, and then A320, 220, and E-jets. So this, you said that 30%? There it is. That's the average percentage across the fleets of the airplanes that are parked. I mean, can't fly them if they're parked. Terrible.
And those engines are incredibly efficient.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, they're massive leaps in technology, but this was a bit of a faux pas, metallurgy.
It's a mega faux pas. So
yeah.
Then another thing, so if you can't get your new airplane, so United 2 years ago, it may have been three now, was supposed to get 100 airplanes from Boeing, 100 airplanes, and they got zero. Now, they made up for it. They found 50 used Airbuses somewhere, and that kept them going. But they were denied 100 airplanes in a single year. So what can you do? You can fly the airplanes you have more, up the utilization. You can not retire. Look, every year we retire a bunch of airplanes, and all of a sudden we don't, because we need them.
Right.
I mean, the 717 may be an older, less efficient airplane, but a paid-for airplane when you got somebody that wants to go somewhere is a wonderful thing. So we keep using them, you know. And, you know, when I first got to Delta, they were going to retire the DC-9s when I first got there. And 10 years later, they had just finished actually retiring the airplanes. So effect on pilot hiring, 2 or 3 years to resolve the engine problems, 1,000 planes short. A reminder that the airplanes we get are typically half for growth, half for retirement pilots. So only half the number times 12, 6,000 pilots. Less demand at the majors slows everybody. That was that lull in the summer of last year. So less hiring at the top, less hiring at the regionals, fewer CFIs moving up to the regionals. Everything comes to a stop. And we felt it big time. But still, last year was 4,000 pilots. You know,
yeah, not too bad.
A respectable number, but nothing like the 12 or 13 we'd enjoyed before. Okay, so you know, made a number of forecasts in the past. Economy's recovering, return profitable. Profits are key. Profits are going to get more planes, go more places. You know, uncertainty over tariffs and fuel, major hiring returned. Cargo is sort of a special situation. So FedEx lost the contract to UPS. UPS was hiring, FedEx was not. FedEx is back hiring now. So I predicted it would be a relatively short downturn for them, and they're recovering. Domestic recovered first. those airlines, low-cost airlines with a simple fleet, you know, the Allegiant, Frontier, even Southwest benefited from having just one fleet. So they don't, if they did cut back, they don't have to crane on the way back up with six different types like Delta, United, American.
Right.
You know, so that's a good thing. Furloughs, we already talked about, there really weren't any. There's the WARN Act warning 10,000 and another 10,000 were to come, saved by the CARES Act. Forecast, I was saying 7,500 early this year, looking more like 8,000 now. Third best year in history. You know, we can, no need to talk about the 865. I do think it'll go to 67 at some point. I know a lot of young pilots are sad about that. A reminder that you lose the first 2 years, you gain two more years at 40,000 a month. So in the long term, it'll be okay. In the short term, it's not okay. So out of date chart, but my point is we're looking for airlines that have a fleet plan. And United has the most ambitious fleet plan out there. It's so ambitious, some people say they can't do it. But far better to have a fleet plan you can't quite do than not to have as strong a fleet plan. So fleet plans are very important. Another point is that FedEx and UPS, they use a lot of converted airplanes. So their future is not totally predicted by the orders and options. It's somewhat predicted by the availability of conversion airplanes into freighters. But orders and options, this, I'll say an old chart. Don't use these numbers, but the concept is what I want to get. So equipment growth, you know, lots of airplanes coming around the world, a smaller percentage in the U.S., but we are the biggest market. So a small percentage growth in the U.S. still yields a large number of pilots demand.
And can we just state those numbers if you go back a slide? I think it's
sure.
Total estimated U.S. demand is 92,740 pilots.
Right. That's growth and retirement. And
right.
By 2034.
Yeah.
By 2034.
And the, so the next 8 world years. Demand, 280,000.
That is wild. That is wild.
92,740. How many airline pilots are in service right now?
I mean, about 115,000. So it's got to double.
So by 2034, we basically need to replace everybody.
I need to add to everybody. We won't replace
it. Add to it.
Yeah, we'll replace a portion of it. I'll show a chart later that shows that trend from the current.
Oh, it's still 92,000. That's doubling, basically, what we
Amazing.
Have today.
Right. U.S. Wow. demand, yep. So lots of deliveries, you know, smaller percent. Other regions are growing faster percentage-wise, you know, but ours is a smaller percentage of a very big market. So the question is, you know, this is historical. If it did this, can it do this? My answer, my eyes say yes, it's achievable. Same thing here. So we have a Great Recession, you know, 9/11, Great Recession. This was a future forecast. We didn't know what it was going to be, but we knew the shark's teeth was going to come every 7 to 10 years. You know, you don't want to buy your captain's house here. You want to buy it here. Okay. So yeah. Don't, you know, the boat, the plane, the luxury car, this is going to be up and down, you know, how much up and down, you know, these are the RPMs, revenue passenger miles, 9/11, Great Recession, COVID, you know, it's coming. This is one of my favorite charts, an older chart, way out of date, but this is the relationship between GDP and passenger traffic. I mean, it's a one-to-one. I mean, like
one
I said,
to one.
This is a commodity. Think of it as a commodity. You want to know how things are going to affect our industry? What would it do to the price of bread? You know, we are a commodity.
Yeah, the economy sneezes, the airline catches the cold.
Yeah, and I'll show you one here in just a minute. So this is the recessions, the length of recessions from 1855, or if you want to look at it from 1945. But recessions are actually much shorter and much less frequent than they used to be. The airlines are doing a much better job of managing their businesses to a profit. Not everybody, but most of them are doing a much better job. So this is the one you were just talking about. So what happens to the airlines? The economy catches a cold and the airlines catch the flu. You know, so we swing higher and we go lower. You know, it just happens every, this was a great recession. Happens every time. So plan ahead, you know. We do a forecast. We take these equipment numbers times the projected airplanes, pilots per plane. Big differences in pilots per plane. Fractionals, about 5, and the big airlines, 13.6, and that's actually climbing. The one with the highest would probably be United. They have the highest percentage of international flying, the most wide bodies on order. So, you know, if you want to fly a wide body captain, long range international, this is where it's at. Not everybody wants to do that. I've done both. The most fun I had was flying my 737 out of Chicago all around the country, coast to coast. You know, that was my as much fun flying as I had. I made more money going to Europe and back on a 767. So this is, I analyzed Delta. I mean, I was at Delta, so I had more information. But this is the pilots per aircraft. And they used the 350 on all longer flights. The A330 is actually the longest range airplane, but it also mixes in some shorter flights. And the 767-400, I can't split out the 7576. I don't have the data. But you can see that the narrow bodies are running 14, 13.5, and the wide bodies 24.5. Big difference.
Pilots per plane.
Yeah. So the joke is when the bulge on the 747 was for the captain's wallet. Okay. So it's got, wide bodies play 30, 40% more. And it also ups your retirement contribution 30 or 40% more. So, but, you know, making wide body captain before you retire doesn't really do the same thing that making wide body captain 10 years before you retire. You need to get there and stay there a while. If you're not going to do that, then the narrow body flying is going to be most of what wide body flying would be just for a short time. So there's the pilots per aircraft. There's a split between captains and co-pilots. And Delta is an unusual airline. So at American and United, go over 8 hours, you get an extra co-pilot. Go over 12 hours, you get two extra co-pilots. At Delta, you get a co-pilot and a captain. And that balances up the captains a little bit. But the ultra long range stuff, and then of course, you can see that they're pretty well even on all the narrow bodies, except this one. And that's got a little bit of wide body mixed in because of the 767. So
makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then if you want to fly wide bodies, here's where they live. You know, nobody has wide bodies like the cargo companies do, and FedEx more than anybody. And then United, Delta, American, and Alaska picked them up with the merger with Hawaiian.
Oh, there you go, Tate.
Yeah.
Okay.
He flew that Hawaiian, now yep. Alaska.
So cargo fleets expected to double. They're growing about twice as fast as the passenger business, but they're only about 10%. So I caution people, and everybody's not going to be a cargo pilot. Not everybody wants to be a cargo pilot, but they're going to stay about 10% of the market. Here's a chart that shows where it, in 23, 28, and 33, still about 10% of the market. Okay, that's what cargo is going to hold. These are good jobs, great equipment, good pay and benefits. They're typically in the top half or even near the top of the pay and benefits. They do work a little harder. You know, I get hits all the time from the FedEx pilots. I say that I average them at 91 hours. And they say, you know, we don't fly 91 hours. We fly 85 hours a month. And then I have to ask them how many months in a year? And their answer should be 13. So you got to divide that extra 85 hours by 12 and divide it and add it back to the other months to get. So they work hard and they make good money. So what can I say? The reason UPS is so high is that they have a flat amount. All co-pilots make the same. All captains make the same. And that average number is slightly higher than most other airlines. They also have a retirement program, a formula like everybody else, which doesn't really get used below 30 years. They're doing a flat dollar amount times years of service, and that actually yields a higher number than the formula. So they do very well. Like I said, for me, I'm a night guy up until about midnight. And then after midnight, I'm a sleepy guy. So I went out with my ID card and rode around, sat in the comfy chair while they sorted the boxes and decided that was not for me, even though I love to work till 12 or 1 in the morning. I hate to work past that. So it wasn't for me. So world traffic growing 5%, U.S., 60% of that. RPMs, freight stuff going twice that rate. traffic down 5% as of 9/11, another 5% with the Great Recession, and COVID down 10%, but we're back. You know, it recovered. Here's something most people don't realize. This is, again, an older chart, but Allegiant, Frontier, and Spirit grew 140% from 2010 to 2017. American, Delta, United grew like 5%. And you say, but they're so much bigger. You know, American and America West and US Air, Delta, Northwest, United, Continental, that's how they got bigger. They didn't get it through market share. Look what happened coming out of COVID. The ultra low cost airlines just killed it. I mean, absolutely killed it. They came out, you know, single fleet, mostly domestic flying. They were right on top of all the benefits coming out of COVID. And then many people would say they ran off the cliff and failed to look down, because after that tremendous growth, they're overextended. And this is Frontier in green, my favorite low-cost airline. You know, there's 100%. So they're all above 100%. But look at Frontier. You know, that's 175%. So really doing good. Utilization, hidden factor. So people accuse me all the time of over forecasting, and my forecasts have been relatively accurate. And the thing that they leave out is utilization. If you're flying 10 hours, you know, and when the recovery comes and the economy's booming, you're flying 15 hours, how many more pilots do you need? Right. 50% more pilots, right. No more equipment, right. Same number of airplanes. And then people say, well, if you increase the utilization of the airplanes, why don't you just increase the utilization of the pilot? Well, you can't do that. There's laws about that.
There's a hard limit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
30 and 7, 8 and 24, 1,000 hours a year, 83 hours a month. You can only go so far with that. So if you're going to actually utilize your airplanes more, you're going to have more pilots. That's a good thing. So here's the utilization change by category coming out of COVID. And we might notice that the regional jet got whacked because we had to park 500 of them, you know. And then the narrow bodies did very well. The wide bodies were lagging because the wide bodies were doing most of the long range international that was up against quarantine when you got there. So we all know somebody who works 10 days a month and somebody who works 20 days a month. So a few years back, we analyzed all the bid sheets for the major airlines. And it turns out that typical major airline pilot works 15.2 days a month. The average 9-to-5 worker, by the way, works 22 days a month. That is 7 days off per month for the rest of your life. Now, they're not 8-hour days. I'm not saying that work hours are less. I'm just saying you get a lot of work done and you get a lot of time off. So 85 hours for pay, 170 on duty and in uniform at the airport divided by 4. There's your 40-hour week right there. But the rub is you're going to be gone 240 to 340 away from home. And most people are at work. When you leave your driveway till you get back to your driveway, you're at work. So paid for 85, but working 170 and gone 240 to 340.
Such a great slide for anybody who's considering the career or wants some perspective on their work schedule. This is like great.
Now, those are the duty regulations that would limit, you know. So in my experience, these rest rules, a lot of people, you know, that are non-union initiated and feel that, you know, we're ripping the airline off by having these regulations that protect us, keep us. That's so you can't go to Europe and sit 5 days and come back and only get paid for flying over and back. But the fact is that these regulations only kick in about 5% of the time. Most of the time, the airline schedules around these rules, so they don't normally do it. And you can bet that it's going to cost the company less to leave you in Oslo and bring you back 5 days later than it is to bring another crew over and fly the airplane back. So they're making business decisions about what to do. And every now and then you get 3 days in Madrid, you know, which is a wonderful thing, but we're not ripping the airline off. They're just making business decisions and you're making sure you're paid when you work. So
that's called trip rig.
Yeah, trip rig, duty rig, all that. So you do get room, transport, meals, uniform, cleaning, all that stuff. Aircraft pilot ratio trending up because we get more training. We had ADS-B and whatever else you get, auto brakes, whatever, and you end up getting more training, right. You know? So only the MD-88 added 717 didn't have auto brakes at AirTran because they didn't buy them. Okay, so utilization trending up, more pilots needed. Here's a snapshot at Delta a while back with the A330, the longest range airplane, getting 17 hours a day, and the 717, the shortest range airplane, getting 11. That is a huge percentage difference. I mean, it's just huge. Right. A lot more pilots per plane as a result. Cargo did really good in 22, 23. We had the cargo space go away from underneath the passenger airplane, the big ones, because they didn't use them. But the when they came back after COVID, the freight companies leveled off a little bit. So I am very optimistic for cargo long range. You know, I teach my course for Sanders in Jasper, Alabama, which is a very small place. But they've got a purple box and a brown box on every corner, you know. And that's not true around the world. You know, you go to Europe, Asia, there's not a purple box and a brown box on every corner. But my forecast is there's going to be, because these freight companies have done a tremendous job of consolidating the local freight forwarding process. So they're going to have a purple and a brown box on every corner all over the world. And there's a lot of world left for them to conquer. So I'm very optimistic. The only problem we have to worry about there is single pilot or no pilot operations. So
right.
Pilot retirements, very strong. American with the best. One thing though, let's say that be sure to look at percentages. You know, it's not numbers, it's percentages. If you have 10 pilots and you hire 10 pilots, everybody's a captain. If you have 17,000 pilots and hire 10 pilots, you might get a weekend off. You know, it's percentages, not numbers. So we have some airlines with some very large numbers and large percentages. That's a good thing. So this is a Continental United, you know, up here in the 600 to 700 range. And there's United, cumulative 10,000 to 2035 starting in 2014. Here's what Delta looked like before COVID, the early retirements. Now it's down, still strong, but it's down. This is what happened at Delta. So there's their early retirements. That's like one, wow. Two, three, wow. Four times, four Jeez. Years worth of retirements in 1 year. And American and wow. And United look the same. So this is what Delta was before COVID, and this is what Delta is now. Still very strong, and really pretty strong all the way out to 2050, you know. So looking good. Retirements we talked about before. This is really my favorite chart on this area. So you've got your current pilots, and they retire. And then the business grows, and you so that really the total need for pilots is a combination of retirements and growth. Now we're very strong on retirements right now, normally 50-50, but heavy on retirements right now. Productivity, like we said, 1,000 divided by 12, 83 hours a month. Most pilots are there. Hard hours, these are hard hour limit, don't include credit time for minimum day training, duty time, vacation, sick leave, or trip duty, any of that stuff. So you can actually get paid for a lot more. Population, you know, the point here is that since it's a commodity, people buy our commodity, and we've trained these people to take an airplane to go somewhere. I mean, for vacation or business, they don't get in a Winnebago and go to the beach. They get on an airplane and go to Aruba or Asia or Europe. And their demand for our commodity is going to remain strong. We've trained them. You know, as long as they have the money to afford it, they're going to use air travel. Okay. So I'm being attacked by my dog. Hold on. Hey, Papa. Yeah. I got a new golden retriever puppy. So he's heading out. Okay, so this is another one of my old charts, but I put it up there because in a commodity, what happens in commodity sales when the price goes down? You sell more of it. What happens in a commodity when you get more choices? So now instead of a loaf of bread, we've got rye, raisin, wheat, you know, think about it. Price goes down, choices go up. It's a great place to be for a commodity. Look at what happened since 2010 and the Great Recession. Airfares, you know, in blue, right here. Look at everything else.
Have decreased.
Gas, electricity, rent, mortgage, food.
And is that, and that's not inflation adjusted. So no. Real, in real dollars, airfares have come down.
Oh yeah. And the beauty of it is that it's a commodity. So when the price goes down, you sell more of it. Here's another way to look at it. Most recently, 19 to 23, airfares up 0.7, gasoline up 34, you know?
Right.
And that's a great place to be if your business happens to be a commodity. Now, we know it's going to go up a little with the fuel prices and all, but we have quite a bit of room before we would be, you know, the 20% fare increase would just put us even with all items, you know, not necessarily a big negative. This is, again, the same thing. Real transportation costs go down. Places you can go goes up. That's a place to be for a commodity. Okay. So final thing, recession. You know, they come and go. We're supposed to have had one. We had a little short one after COVID, but, you know, it's going to happen. So, and it's going to affect the commodity when it does. Labor, we're always under pressure. The company's job is to save money, and the union's job is to cost them more money for your services. If they're not fighting about it, somebody's not doing their job. So they're going to be fighting about it. I say, learn the issues, tell your union rep what you want, go play golf, because you're one vote out of 17,000. It's not going to make that big a difference. Right. The good news is it gradually creeps up over time, and we're beating inflation now. And it goes levels off in hard times. If it's really hard times, it goes down a little bit. But long term, we are beating inflation. So, and I'll show you that chart later. So terrorism, ever present, but no overreaction like last time. Mergers, most of them have happened, you know, certainly with the Alaska, Hawaiian pretty much cleans up the big ones that are available. Fuel prices, well, they're headed up. Flow agreements. There was a time when American hired 60% of their pilots from the flow. That didn't last very long, but I think not so much for the pilots who might be watching today, but for their children, most of it's going to be a flow agreement to a major airline. New entrants, very hard to start an airline. Used to be $5 million and an ex-airline manager, you're ready to go. Now you better have $150 million and a whole team that knows what to do. Starting airlines is really hard to do. We watched the DOT, half of the airlines that register to start an airline, half of them never start. And of the half that do start, 5% make it 5 years. So every now and then, you know, somebody merges in the Southwest, Morris merges in the Southwest, very rare. Most cases, they don't make it. Pandemic could return or linger. Tariffs, immigration, who knows? Single pilot cockpit, slow transition. I would, on immigration, I would ask people to read the, there's a report out by, that looks at 30 years of immigration and what it means to the economy. And it sort of goes against the current immigration is bad. We have a shrinking population right now. We need about a 3% annual growth to sustain our country at its current level. And we're not going to be able to do that with a shrinking internal population and without immigration. So we need to study that before we say we don't like it. We need to look at the effects of it. So this is a chart. This is IATA, and they have a current chart. I haven't updated it. I apologize. But if you'll go to IATA.com, you can get all the risk factors and how they rate them. Everybody knows we had the worst recession ever as a result of policies of the last administration. And yet there were inflation rates that were double or almost triple that in the past. So that's just wrong. The amazing part is that it went back down so quick. That's the amazing part. We get $243 billion in the airlines and restrict supply, and we get inflation. Surprise, surprise. The real surprise is it goes back down to normal within a year or two. I mean, it's crazy.
Right.
There's fuel prices. So we talked about fuel prices. High fuel prices are bad. Low fuel prices are good. But if you're going to run a business, what you really need are constant fuel prices. Constant fuel prices, you can manage your business to a profit. They go down, you make a lot of money. They go up, you're going to lose money. But this up and down stuff, unstable, that is the worst thing for airline fuel prices. Here's the fuel cost, you know, up and down, up, back down below. 230. I mean, it's manageable if it stays there. This is 2025. 2026 does not look like that. It's at, what was it, four something. So we're back up in here. Scary stuff. We talked about that one and that one and that one. Yeah, I'm done. So we'll have to cut that off.
This was fascinating, Kit. Thank you.
Well, here's one that you might want to add. So this is a share of the pie, right? So in good times, the employees tend to get their share of the pie. And in bad times, they may level off or have to give some back. And from 07 until now, we're gradually getting a larger piece of the pie, which is a good thing. And I know you think I'm done, but I'm not. So let me...
let's go. This is great.
Let me get some more stuff here. I need to get to 151. I'm going to skip the regionals and go straight to the majors. Well, there's a fleet total from 1959 till 2025, major airlines. So this is what we call the lost decade, right? From the Great Recession, this is the lost decade. There's Delta Airlines merged with Northeast, Western, and Northwest long term.
Right.
Cargo ton went way up in 21, 22, 23. This is an interesting one. This is the legacy carriers. This is Southwest, and these are the low cost and ultra low cost. Well, they've been doing well market share wise continuously. Spirit went up from 2010 to 2023, 577%.
Wow.
And these guys are still, well, this one's merged, and these guys are still working, and this one's merged. But the big guys, you know, not so much. So here's the career value stuff we mentioned earlier. 30-year career, 12 to 23. Southwest new contract was the top until FedEx had a new contract, and now it's the top. So 30-year average, $17 million. Excellent pay and benefit, retirement, 16 to 18, and benefits, 15. We now have 19 coming at FedEx, and Southwest is at 20. So we have these cash balance plans. A cash balance plan was designed to take the I don't know if that's what they designed it for, but it was used to take the tax and payment requirement to when you exceed the 401k limit, they have to pay you the money and you have to pay tax on it. So it no longer grows tax-free as part of your retirement. Well, United, American, and Delta put and that Delta within the 18%, but Southwest added it above the 18%. So Southwest is now at a 20% retirement. So the things I'm going to show you have an 11-year captain, and everybody says, oh, I know somebody made it sooner than that. Well, I do too. But the idea here, I have to be probable. What you're thinking of is possible. Yes, it's possible to make it sooner, but 51% of the pilots have to bid captain for me to use it in my analysis as an expert witness. So 8 to 10 years would be more normal. Went down a little bit during COVID rush. Now it's back close to 8 to 10. I use 11 to be conservative. No future raises. In other words, what I'm going to show you, these career values don't include next year's raise or the rest of raises in the contract or any new contract. This is at today's rates. No extra flying at 100%. No premium flying at 150 to 200%. A 5% return on the 401k. So I work with people all the time that are injured or whatever. I get to see their 401k. When I retired, my 401k had a 11.76 return. My wife's also a retired United captain. She had about 8.5. I'm working on a guy now for American over the last 8 or 10 years. His average is 13.2. So 5% is very conservative as to what you would earn. So I don't know how to value these lifestyle things, but the ability to upgrade, transition, be in different bases, quality of life, flexibility, income are excellent. I mean, the only person that can not work, like an airline pilot can not work when he wants to not work, are the people that own the business. But a pilot has a mechanism to add a trip, drop a trip, swap a trip, you know?
Yep.
You can't do that in other professions. The only person that can do it is the guy that owns the company. And he's probably working 80 hours a week anyway. So it's all been restored. The history was Delta got the pay raise back, and then United got the pay raise and the work rule, and American threw their contract out and got the same pay raise and work rules. And Delta is a little behind on the work rules, but they haven't had a contract yet, and you bet they'll get every bit of it back when they do. So 100% unionized. A lot of people are not so sure about unions, but the only answer to a large company is a large union, and that's what produces the values we're going to see here. So hiring requirements, hours you fly, this is the maximum, the guarantee, and the average, and it's normally about in the middle. And I already talked about FedEx and UPS because they actually work a little harder than the rest of us, and they make a little more as a result. When you talk to a pilot about what they make, this is what they're going to tell you. This is the W-2. They don't know much about this part, the retirement benefits, A funds, which are defined benefit, B funds, defined contribution. They don't talk much about that. And there's another third above what they have on their W-2 that they don't know that much about. And they're probably going to be embarrassed to tell you what their W-2 was. So what you need to do as an aspiring pilot is compare what you have to what they have. So what did you make last year? How many days do you work a month? Blah, blah, blah. Compare that to what you have. Don't worry about what they used to have. They don't really understand it anyway. So if you want to fly international, you know, Delta, United, American, and you can see United's made a very aggressive recovery internationally after COVID. So they're way up there. Pay rates. So this is the old pay rates on a chart, about 353. And you can add three zeros to get the annual pay if you don't do anything extra. And then we have the 2026 pay rates, 474, with the starting pay as a captain of 314. Add the three zeros. So United hired some captains off the street, you know, very unusual, but that's what we're looking at. So here's the first officer rates, 323, 12 years.
Do you see pilot pay rates increasing over the next 5 to 10 years by a certain clip? What's your forecast there?
I think they will beat inflation. I'll show you. Yeah. I've got that figured. First, we'll do the retirement. So before this all started, this was 16%. I thought that was very generous. Okay. Southwest TA, 16%. And then they added, it went to 18% in the next contract. And then they added the 2% cash balance plan. So these guys, American, United, 18, Delta, 18, they've added it as well. And Southwest, 18 plus 2. Look at the Spirit didn't even have a retirement when we started looking at it, but they've all come up to 15 or 16%. So cash balance plans are in yellow. So those are the cash balance plans. Delta would have one as well. Delta would have one inside of this at 18, but inside of it.
And if you want to learn more about cash balance plans, market-based cash balance plans, go back. We did an episode on that and deep dive.
So here's the retirement yield. If you have the current retirements and the retirement yield, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. This would be what you would have in your retirement plan with a 5% return investment and the progression we said, 11 years to captain, normal fleet, that type of stuff. So Allegiant is the least, and Southwest is the best passenger. Atlas is the least, and FedEx, well, UPS is the best initially because they have that same pay for all co-pilots. And then they, by the time you get to 30 years, they're tied.
Right.
4.9 million. This is the new grid calculating the pay, FedEx with the TA, which was passed. Southwest was the highest career value at 35 years. And now FedEx is the highest career value by a wide margin.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So FedEx is leading the pack now.
It is.
With that new TA.
Whoever has the last contract is usually the winner. And I should have had UPS should have been the greed on here. Southwest and UPS were about even. So they pay about the same. And here's FedEx, head and shoulders above everybody else. Average almost $18 million for all the majors. And FedEx TA was approved. Average it's at 18. So here's the history of the pay raises from 2010 to 2028. And you asked me about what's happening in the future. Well, here's the projected average percent increase in the future. 2, 3.4, 3, and 3.
Right.
Average inflation rate is 2.3 or 4. There it is, 2.47. So on average, this will beat the inflation. On average.
Right.
Now, that was the question. Highest pay rate at the end of the contract, FedEx, $5.12 an hour.
$5.12. Very nice.
I think $5 $5.12 was my first hourly rate on my first year line.
Divided by 100. Yeah, I wanted to bring up something that I thought was fascinating. This is just for everyone listening out there, obviously has a, you know, some sort of interest in finance. I did a little bit of an analysis on, you know, the terminal value of my 401k at the end of my career and how much of that is contribution and how much is interest. And it's interesting. I mean, after you have, you know, $1 million, $2 million in that account, the contributions for the last, you know, 15, 20 years of your career are dwarfed by the investment returns.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at, you know, age 50, 55, 60, up until retirement, the company is dumping a bunch of money into that account for you, and you might be as well. But the amount that you're making on an annual basis on those compounded returns is just massive. And so in any case, you know, that's the seventh wonder of the world, right, is compound interest.
Yeah, I agree. So this is a chart of the pilot pay raises in blue and inflation in orange. And we're keeping up very nicely. I had somebody give me a hard time about, I used the consumer price index one time instead of inflation. And they said they weren't the same. Well, they are the same. So I plotted them both. So here's the profit sharing. I don't have all the companies that have profit sharing. I don't have enough history. But on average, it adds $656,000 to your income for those companies that have profit sharing. Delta has the best formula, 21.5 paid back in 2015. But I might add that American and United matched the Delta formula in their last contracts. Now, Delta has been a little more profitable. So if they're more profitable, the same formula will still yield more profits. But the Delta average, 8.9. And the Delta average yield, almost $1 million during your career for profit sharing. So there it is on a chart. So pretty much the same stuff. Here's that corporate analysis I did from 20 to 22. And the average increase, co-pilots and captains, 56 and 48%. So basically airlines, I would say rising water floats all boats. So in the airlines pretty much got a 30% raise in the last contracts and 20% of it right away, and the other 10% over the next few years. So a 30% raise all at once. This is my most favorite chart. It has not been updated for FedEx new contract. But this chart, like I said, I recommend that you follow me on LinkedIn or Facebook or something. I put this particular chart got 700,000 views, well over 1 million last year on the other stuff too. So worth looking at. And I've got that one chart that I promised. Okay, so this is the American Airlines captain pay from 1975 till today. Started out at $54 on a 737 small aircraft, and today it's $336 an hour on the same airplane. If you do inflation, if you take and apply inflation to that $54, it goes up 660%, which is to 336, but the actual current rate is 382. So we're beating inflation. This is the lost decade.
Wow.
This is from 9/11 till after the Great Recession. And you can see it very clearly. But we were back in 2013, and we are taking off now in and when COVID hit in 2021, it's really, really heading up. So other things I've got here, I've got a seniority model. This one's on the internet too. This is a master seniority list and how seniority works, initial class assignments at the bottom. And I believe we're done.
Well, Kit, this has been super helpful. Can you let the listeners know one more time how to best get in touch with you on more information, how to follow your newsletter, things like that?
Sure. I don't have a newsletter anymore. So it's just kitdarby.com for products and services, which are primarily resumes, application reviews, interview prep, and career counseling or planning. That's most of what I do. So I've enjoyed it.
Sounds great.
It's been fantastic. Well, and this has been our longest episode that we've ever recorded after, you know, 150 or so. And man, the time flew by. So I hope the listeners got as much out of it as we did. Again, you know, thank you for your time. It's really interesting to see those charts and the math. And I think if I was to summarize everything that we learned today, it's that it's never been a better career to be in over the next 20, 25 plus years. I mean, things are going really well. And while there might be a few temporary dips, yeah, it's a great place to be.
Yeah, by my favorite saying, it's a great time to be or become an airline pilot.
Absolutely.
And thanks, Kit, for your service to the industry and your service to the military. I know that you contributed a lot to the pilot community, and that, you know, shows in the numbers and the data and the things and the people that you've helped. So thank you so much for all that as well.
All right.
It's been great.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you again. Take care.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening to the show. Before you leave, don't forget, we're meeting for the PIP Live events on October 8th and 9th in Las Vegas, Nevada. If you enjoy our content, what you're hearing, what we're talking about, and you want to network with other pilots that are doing what you're doing, tax and legal and investment professionals, see you in Las Vegas. Go to passiveincomepilots.com to get your tickets. Ticket prices do go up in August, so jump on that as soon as you can. Thanks, everybody.